everyone, welcome to The Great American Bash. My name is Brandon Weatherby. The Great American Bash is a podcast about the intersections of presidential politics and professional wrestling. Co-host and co-author Chris Kelly and I are experts in the field, considering that we're the authors of the book, The Donald, How Trump Turned Presidential Politics into Pro Wrestling. You could find that and pieces that we've written for places like The Washington Post and Slate, Vice, U.S. News and World Reports, and more at presidentwrestler.com. To listen to the newest episode of The Great American Bash, follow us on Facebook. It's facebook.com/gabpod, G-A-B-P-O-D. This episode features an interview with deputy editor at CQ Roll Call, Jason Dick, and was recorded August 24th, 2017. Here's episode 56 of The Great American Bash.
You smell what Barack just cooked.
I'm here to challenge you to a match.
When it comes to standing up for the American people, I am ready to rumble.
I think that we may need a wrestler in the White House.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Great American Bash. My name is Chris Kelly.
My name is Brandon Weatherby.
It's Thursday, August 24th, about 10:40 a.m. in the East Coast. I'm based in D.C. today. Brandon is on the West Coast in Portland. It is day 216 of Donald Trump's presidential title reign. This is a podcast about the intersection of pro wrestling and presidential politics. How you doing today, Brandon?
I'm fine.
Great. So we are definitely recording this, like I said, 10:40 a.m. Definitely not the second time we're recording it. It's been a busy week, as always. Let's get right to our big show. As the Washington Post calls it today, Trump's whiplash, three personas and three speeches, but the same president. This is about Donald Trump's three speeches, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday this week, where he seems to pivot back and forth between different characters, much like Mick Foley did with the Three Faces of Foley run in the mid-90s. Monday, Trump spoke about Afghanistan with some sobriety and seriousness. I would say that was his Mankind speech. Tuesday, his speech in Phoenix, which you called Vintage Trump. That would definitely be the Cactus Jack, the hardcore extreme speech. Wednesday, a conciliatory tone at the American Legion. That's got to be Dude Love, just bringing people together. This morning, Trump tweeted, quote, "The fake news is now complaining about my different types of back-to-back speeches. Well, there was Afghanistan, somber. The big rally, enthusiastic, dynamic, and fun, and the American Legion, respectful and strong. Too bad the Dems have no one who can change tones." So what do you think about the president changing tones like this day to day?
He's right. He is amazing at this, and he should be credited for this. And there are very few wrestlers that have ever been able to pull off a gimmick as silly as this. And Mick Foley happens to be God. If you don't know what we're talking about, read any of his books or watch any Attitude Era Raw featuring Mick Foley, and there are multiple signs saying Foley is God. He's absolutely right. He knows how to play a room better than anyone. And to think that it's stupid doesn't understand why he won on November 8th.
Yeah, and this is a lot of the news coverage of this even has been kind of people being confounded, outraged that he's able to change characters like this, that he's still able to do a speech like Tuesday, go off teleprompter for a 77-minute promo, when that's been the most consistent thing of this entire time of the last couple years since he's been on the political stage. He doesn't change. He's not having a face turn. So I think he just still the kind of thing we've been saying over and over again is to not be surprised and to meet him in the ring on his own terms here.
Here's the thing that's interesting about Foley and Trump. Neither of them look or act or were ever thought to be a future WWE Hall of Famer, period. Trump is clearly not what you would think of in a president or a politician. Clearly didn't matter. Exact same thing with Mick Foley. Not the best look, not the best in-ring style. Perfectly fine in-ring, but not like doing five-star matches. It's more like, I'm going to do death matches, but for a family-friendly company, I don't want to be the guy that has to cover my face and say super weird things, but kids are going to love me. He's a beloved character, and both of them seemingly get well with Linda McMahon.
There you go, and that's the thing that I don't think we've compared the Donald to Mick Foley, but this was, I guess, bound to happen, especially when the Washington Post is making my job much easier in that way.
Also, I've read roughly 1,500 pages that Mick Foley has written. I think I've read three or four, maybe five of his books at this point.
Which one would you recommend to listeners of the show?
Oh, I like Foley is Good, which is the follow-up to the first Mankind book. The difference between Mick Foley and every other WWE book is he actually writes his, and it's very, very clear that he writes his. The second best WWE book, the second best wrestling book I've ever read is actually the Daniel Bryan book, which was a WWE production, but he does not just rave about WWE, and he's spoken, I'd say, 80% of the time talking about his days in the indies. And I don't know how many punches were pulled, but it doesn't seem like any. So, A, number one, Foley is Good. Number two, the Daniel Bryan book. The interesting thing about Foley is Good is he spends like 80 pages really hung up on this really sad tragedy that happened with like some boys died in a backyard wrestling incident, and the WWE and Mick Foley and other people were blamed. He wrote this impassioned sort of like, maybe in retrospect it wasn't such a good idea to say it wasn't our fault and just go and move on because it's a tragedy. He couldn't let that go for 80 pages. And in future books, he wrote about that in the paperback addiction. He wrote, "I went way too long on this. I shouldn't have done that." That's Trump's speech at every rally.
This has gone too long. I shouldn't have done that. The Donald Trump story. So, yes, Foley is God. Trump is not. That's the big story this week, developing kind of still in the wake of Charlottesville. Also in the wake of that, something that happened late last week is the fact that Steve Bannon is out of the administration. We talked about this last time. By the time we recorded last, he had just done his Mooch interview with the American Prospect. A lot of people kind of looking at that as maybe the last straw, but I think it's probably one of many straws that have been kind of turning Trump against Bannon since the administration started.
Oh, yeah. I mean, everyone thought that the Time cover and the SNL skit was going to be the thing that got Bannon out. And that, and from all reports, that was a very big deal at the time. But I clearly don't think this matters. If you look at the history of Trump, Bannon was not there for the birther movement. Bannon was not there in 1990 for the Central Park Five. Bannon was not there in 1973 when the Justice Department sued the Trump Corporation over the Fair Housing Act. So it's not like this is a new thing for Trump to play with racism. So
right.
I don't think that aspect of Bannon leaving will matter in any way. And I think Tuesday's speech proved that.
Right. He can still kind of go to that well, whether Bannon's there or not. I think an interesting thing is kind of seeing as Bannon goes back to Breitbart, this is him in Weekly Standard. "I feel jacked up. Now I'm free. I've got my hands back on my weapons. Someone said it's Bannon the Barbarian. I'm definitely going to crush the opposition. There's no doubt. I built a fucking machine at Breitbart, and now I'm going to go back knowing what I know, and we're about to rev that machine up. And rev it up we will do." So that's kind of Bannon's attempt at a promo. Not the best. When he says someone said it's Bannon the Barbarian, he was definitely that someone. It's kind of like how Triple H says that someone called him the ass kicker, but it's actually just him calling himself the ass kicker. But the interesting thing here is I think Breitbart or even someone like Alex Jones, who has kind of it seems like they have this outsized influence because of the coverage they get, whereas their viewership or their readership is quite small. I would just compare it to kind of ECW's effect in the 90s, where ECW, contrary to kind of the pedography now, not many people were watching. It was a pretty small promotion. It was getting some buzz, but really pretty far underground. It was the fact that its approach to wrestling, the extreme, the hardcore, the sex, the violence, the swearing, all that stuff, started to filter up to WWF and WCW on a large scale. And so a lot of people aren't reading Breitbart, but when Breitbart starts a conspiracy theory, that ends up on Fox and Friends, which then the president is watching the next day. So that's something kind of watch over now that Bannon's out. See if Breitbart changes tone, see if they start attacking Trump or people in Trump's administration, and kind of see how that plays out.
If you've ever been to the 2300 Arena or the ECW Arena, you realize how small it is. and then you think about their reach, and it was definitely more perception versus reality. Zero difference between Milo, zero difference between Breitbart or Bannon. But yeah, your point about the infiltration to the mainstream is definitely the most interesting, least discussed aspect of all of this.
Mm-hmm. So we'll see if that, the coverage of Bannon and Breitbart post being in the administration changes. But, you know, we've been talking about this is who Trump is, whether it's the speech on Tuesday, whether it's the, you know, being investigated by racism by the DOJ in the 70s, all the way through Central Park 5, all the way to now. On Saturday, we kind of had an accidental, possibly accidental, mentioned by Trump, where he kind of spoke to this, where he tweeted, "Our great country has been divided for decades. Sometimes you need a protest in order to heal, and we will heal and be stronger than ever before." Except he spelt it H-E-E-L, the way we use heal. And you read it that way, and it totally makes sense. But unfortunately, some globalist cucks in the administration made him change it to H-E-A-L, changing the meaning of the tweet. But we'll always have that screenshot and this mention on this podcast.
I hope we never have to define that one of the words you just said in the last paragraph. We've defined
heal or globalist cuck.
That one. I hope we never have to define that. I hope people search out on their own. Figure it out.
Yes. Figure it out. Just Google people. You know, one of the things in the speech, if you didn't make it through the 77-minute promo, one of your favorite parts of the show, because it's time to break the walls down.
Build that wall. Now, the obstructionist Democrats would like us not to do it, but believe me, if we have to close down our government, we're building that wall.
Yeah, so that's Donald Trump. Once again, returning to the his campaign promise that they're going to build the wall, whether we have to shut down the government or not to do it. What do you think of the status of the wall these days?
I'm confused more than anything else, because there are some people that support it, absolutely. But he's doing this in Phoenix, knowing it's a Democratic city, knowing he's going to get a reaction, knowing it's not the most popular thing in cities, even cities in the Southwest, and he clearly knows how to poke the bear. He knows what he's doing to rile up a crowd. Clearly, all research shows that, the wall won't help the flow of drugs, because that's whatever.
Right.
I'm not going to just whatever. All I'm saying.
Yeah, we don't deal with facts here. We just deal with perception.
No, all I'm saying is every wrestler deserves good health insurance. Yeah, so does everyone, and maybe that prevents some of the things that lead people to, I don't know, pill addictions and due to pain, due to undiagnosed illness because they can't afford their medical bills. Maybe we fix a healthcare system in a way that is bipartisan. It doesn't take one maverick. My favorite part of the speech was when Trump would yell one vote, seemingly, about 10 different times during that 77-minute promo about Senator John McCain in Arizona. The wall is a great thing to look at about a speech in Arizona that seemingly could have been done in no other place. The wall will affect Arizona greatly. There is zero things to show off about the wall at this point in time. Arizona
right.
has two pretty popular senators. McCain is definitely popular. There was a man that said he should die. That's on Trump's side, outside of the Knot Arena, the convention center, that Meghan McCain responded to. That's nuts. And the other senator is sort of a rising star, sort of not a rising star, maybe probably going to be primary, Jeff Flake. And that's a weird thing to talk about. He's on your team. The wall is no different. The wall definitely fits in on this stuff. It's some good heel work.
Yeah, it's some good heel work, and as always, no matter if he's in Phoenix, a Democratic city, a Democratic state, a state that supports him or not, he draws his fans, the smarty people who are there to cheer for heels instead of baby faces, who are there to say that an 80-year-old American hero with cancer should die. Trump finds his audience, and it was that audience in the wrestling side was definitely in full effect over the weekend in Brooklyn. WWE was there for SummerSlam, which meant an NXT pay-per-view on Saturday, the hours-long pay-per-view of SummerSlam on Sunday and then Raw and SmackDown Monday, Tuesday. I know you don't watch NXT, but I will, as always, recommend the NXT TakeOvers. It's kind of what a wrestling show should be. The storylines all make sense. It's different styles for different people. They did put together a really good event. Unlike SummerSlam, which started, I think, at 3 in the morning and went to about 11 p.m. at night, we watched it together, at least the main event, the main card, I should say. What were your takeaways from SummerSlam?
Best main event match since Daniel Bryan won WrestleMania. The rest of the card was one of the worst. I don't know how long.
Yeah, possibly.
The thing about it was, like, it wasn't so offensively bad that you're just like, this is stupid, this is so bad it's fun. This is just like, this is sort of lackluster, and I respect all of these wrestlers, and I think that they didn't, I don't want to say time was an issue, because seemingly everyone had enough time, just it, a lot of the reasoning behind the matches wasn't there.
Right, and they've been building these for weeks, and just a lot of the matches, everything was far from, except for the main event, which had Roman Reigns, Samoa Joe, Braun Strowman, and Brock Lesnar, all being big, strong men. They didn't really build, even the other stories, just none of them were matches people wanted to see. And that's how you end up with John Cena burying Baron Corbin to start the show, and Nakamura losing like a jobber. I will say that the best wrestling match other than that main event was New Day and Usos, but unfortunately it was on the pre-show, so it's like, it did it even happen at all?
One of the things that I completely forgot about was during Trump's speech in Virginia to the troops about increasing troop levels, and he mentioned India a few times, and he mentioned Pakistan a few times, and that was very surprising, and that actually is possibly going to have worldwide ramifications. And part of me is wondering, did Donald Trump only recently think of India the same way Vince maybe thought, hey, there's a billion people there, we should have Jinder Mahal be champion? And I think that's some conspiracy theory stuff that maybe we should all explore. I'm just throwing it out there, guys.
We should look into it. Yeah, we should see. Does Trump know that India exists because of WWE champion Jinder Mahal? That sounds perfectly logical to me. Unlike most of the booking that Jinder Mahal has had since he came back to the company. So SummerSlam, long event, great main event. Post-SummerSlam this week in Brooklyn, John Cena is back to Raw, where he can give the rub to Roman Reigns and this new generation of stars. On SmackDown, a little lower down the card, Bobby Roode, the glorious Bobby Roode, up from NXT, and Shelton Benjamin back after about probably a decade out of the company, at least 5 years out of the company. These are little roster moves, tweaks here and there to try to get things back on track. But even with SummerSlam and NXT and all this, the biggest wrestling stories of the week weren't actually in the WWE. 2 days ago, UFC light heavyweight champion John Jones, Bones Jones, came out that he had tested positive for steroids before his last fight at UFC 214. That kind of a fight that ended a feud I wrote about for on Byte Sports, his feud with Daniel Cormier. Very much looks at this point, after being suspended twice, once before for performance-enhancing drugs, could very well be the end of John Jones in UFC, which would be a shame because he is a great fighter. He's just a mess of a person. After he won and ended his feud with Daniel Cormier, like a good pro wrestler, he was already starting to book his next feud when he called out Brock Lesnar. And a lot of people have been talking about this as kind of a UFC dream match, this kind of, different weight class, but two of the biggest stars ever to come out of UFC. So while it looks like it might not actually happen there, this is now time to fantasy book Jon Jones and Brock Lesnar as a main event match at WrestleMania.
Yeah, that's going to happen. It can't not happen at this point, unless McGregor wants it instead. It's going to be Lesnar versus a different MMA guy. The end.
Right. And so it definitely looks like the WWE wants it that way. And if they could get the kind of money that these fights get, or if these guys don't have the options to make the money that they would make before. I mean, the WWE has a history of this. At WrestleMania 24, the Big Show had a main event match with Floyd Mayweather, a match that is actually better than it has any right to be. And Mayweather, once again, having kind of a spectacle of a match. I mean, even though it is marginally more legitimate than a WrestleMania match, he's fighting Conor McGregor this weekend, Saturday night, in a match that's very much the promotion has definitely been ripped from, you know, pro wrestling promos. Two guys that are very familiar with it. Conor McGregor, who does the Vince McMahon strut, who presents himself like Ric Flair. These are guys who understand how you make money with something, and it's often by being a heel, and they're both great heels. So yeah, we'll see if...
Hold on. I feel very stupid right now. We completely forgot about Ronda. Ronda Rousey is most likely going to be in the WWE by the time next Mania rolls around. You clearly just have her versus Charlotte, and then you have Brock versus Ivan McGregor or Jones, and you build the whole thing as when worlds collide, and you actually sell pay-per-views because it'll be Ronda's first time back in any sort of ring in, like, what, 2 years? And clearly Brock versus anyone is always a great five-minute spectacle. So, yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
That's actually a really good point that we didn't think of. But, yes, Ronda Rousey, who, since her last loss, has been out of the public eye, but there's rumors that she's training with Brian Kendrick of the WWE. She appeared at WrestleMania 31 in 2015, did a little spot and kind of teased a fight with Stephanie McMahon. And this was at the height of her powers, when she was still on top of UFC and not at this point where she looks like she will no longer fight again in UFC. Yeah, that's a really good point. If she is kind of on schedule for it, they've also got one of her. They're also kind of teasing the four horsewomen of the UFC women versus the four horsewomen women of the WWE. Shayna Baszler of the UFC is also, or of MMA, is also in the WWE now. She's in the Mae Young Classic. So yeah, there's definitely, these worlds will be colliding. You know, the Mayweather-McGregor, the boxing versus MMA, or boxing versus WWE, or UFC versus WWE, I think we're just at the beginning, because we're at a place where a lot, for various reasons, some of UFC's biggest stars will no longer be fighting for UFC, and they'll need to make money somewhere. So why not WWE?
Here's an interesting point that we don't ever bring up, is the money for this. If you're a special attraction, you can get a pretty good payday from the WWE that doesn't, like, cause that much CTE or that much internal bleeding or any life or career-ending injuries, and you leave strong, and you don't have to worry about, if I lose, will I make X amount of money my next fight? This is now, we're entering this weird, wonderful time where, like, is the WWE more financially savvy for these performers than UFC? This is sort of like football versus wrestling in the 40s and 50s. Like, where can I make more money for longer? It might be wrestling.
Yeah. You know, that's a really good point, as these guys, and men and women, are looking for ways to extend their career. Yeah, I think fake fighting ends up being a real outlet. I mean, Floyd allegedly made, you know, $20 million when he did allegedly, in big quotes. Tyson made several million at WrestleMania 14. The money that they took, that they were going to pay Bret Hart, they just paid Mike Tyson instead. So yeah, it's a good payday, and you don't got to take a lot of bumps. And that's the big lesson of the WWE. We're going to close this show with your interview with CQ's Jason Dick. Tell me a little about that conversation.
So Jason's been covering Congress for a very long time. And I mean that in a good way. That's not an insult in any way. He's been covering it for multiple generations. So he has a very unique perspective. And one of the things that I wanted to know about was, is any of it actually any different than what it was 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 15 years ago? So we talk a little bit about that. But the reason why I wanted Jason on this week is because, in addition to covering Congress, in addition to covering guys like Mitch McConnell, he is from Arizona. And he also has property in Arizona. So he understands Arizona media and Arizonians and people from Arizona, which is where the Trump rally was held. So we watched the rally together, and we sort of watched the not riot, whatever you want to call it, the aftermath of that, and talked about what was expected, what happened, how it was going to play in Arizona, and if there's any Democrats that have any chance of challenging Trump on mic.
All right. And with that, here's CQ's Jason Dick.
What's your actual title?
Leadership and Enterprise Editor at CQ Roll Call.
But that means you kind of have to know a little bit about everything?
Yes.
How long have you been covering
Congress? Well, actually, it's appreciated, but not necessary.
Okay. How long have you been covering Congress in one capacity or another?
17 years.
17 years. You've been to a lot of conventions, political conventions.
Actually, just the two last year. No, three. I'm sorry. I went to the one in Denver too.
Okay,
in 2008. So three, the two last year and the one in Denver.
You've been to a lot of rallies.
I have been to a lot of rallies.
It is currently 11:41 on Tuesday, August 22nd, just after Trump wrapped his Phoenix rally.
Right. It would be a little earlier if Arizona had daylight savings time, but they don't.
I really wish that this was on the East Coast. So thanks for doing this, number one. Number two, have you seen anything like this so far out from an election?
No.
Okay.
I haven't. Yeah, it seems... I mean, because I was flashing a little bit to right before the election and also to the convention. I mean, you and I have spent some time at the convention mm-hmm. in Cleveland. This even went a little further because, I mean, his speech at the convention was long, but it wasn't as kind of strange and divergent, I don't think.
There are more protesters right now in Phoenix than there were in Cleveland.
Yes, absolutely.
Not even close.
Right.
Well, I think that's easy to explain. Like, no one thought this was going to happen.
Right. No one thought, and no one was prepared. I mean, Hillary Clinton's still hiking around trying to figure out what happened.
Which is fair. I get that.
Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, it's shock to the system. But no, I mean, this was, I mean, if you're a Republican in Congress and you wanted to hear the president talk about, I don't know, tax reform or anything like that. I mean, he mentioned a couple of those things, but like it was like a sliced pickle in this gigantic sandwich, just gigantic Dagwood sandwich of attacks on the media, of calling out, not by name, but calling out John McCain and Jeff Flake, teasing the crowd about pardoning Sheriff Joe Arpaio for, you know.
He mentioned Sheriff Joe. What, like 30 minutes into a 77-minute speech?
Something like that.
And tax reform maybe at minute 60?
I think it was 30. The first mention of it was at minute 38, and like 38, 39, 40, and then at the very end. And it was just like, we're going to lower your taxes, and business taxes are bad.
Okay.
Not a ton of detail.
No.
Not a ton of policy detail.
Nor was there last night, on Monday night, when the president spoke. That's a very weird thing to say into a microphone. When the Donald spoke to the troops in Virginia.
Right.
Not a lot of details there. But my guess is that the majority of Americans felt a little bit more positive about Monday night's speech. Is that fair?
Probably. Although, I mean, I don't know. I mean, I haven't seen too much polling on it, and being sort of an elite Washington journalist, even though I'm from Cottonwood, Arizona, I think I'm tainted now. I'm a swamper or a swamp creature. But I can't help but think that people, when they think about Afghanistan, when they hear about it, they have a lot of sympathy for the troops, and they wonder, is this thing ever going to end? Or is this going to be like Korea, where like the war is still going on, you know, almost 80 years later? I mean, it's just this like it's this kind of amazing 70 years later. It's this amazing thing of like I don't know how much. I mean, it wasn't a terribly negative speech last night, but it also like who tunes in for that? I mean, I guess 28 million people watched it, but that's still I don't know.
Do you think that's low for a first-year president in terms of viewership?
That would seem to be a little low.
Okay.
Does it probably get more than the nightly newscasts.
Does it matter, though? Because everyone knows about it. Everyone heard it.
Everyone heard it.
Everyone that wanted to hear it, heard it.
Yeah. But I guess that, you know, are most Americans tuning in? No. I mean, are they engaged? Do they really want to know what happened? And do they really want to like tune in to hear him talk about like the like,
see
the
I don't
increase?
Think this conversation matters because there's so many ways to gauge viewership these days.
Right.
I mean, if you stream it on Twitter, which you could have, does that count as a viewer?
Right. But who is anybody really watching it on Twitter?
I mean, we technically watch this on a YouTube stream.
We did, but we're nerds. I mean, like, we're not real Americans, Brandon. We're elitists. You're from Chicago.
Yeah.
And we
we're not part of America.
Right. We're not part of America.
That.
Like, you know.
You know what you are a part of, though, is Arizona. You are technically a property owner in the great state of Arizona.
Yes.
Okay. You were in Arizona last week.
Yes.
You were in Arizona right after the tragedy in Charlottesville?
Actually, we got into Phoenix the night of Charlottesville as it was happening.
So you knew that that tonight's event in Phoenix was going to happen. You knew that people in Phoenix said, please don't let this event happen. What did you think as both a resident of Arizona but a journalist in D.C.? What did you think was going to happen, and what did you want to happen?
I thought this is kind of fascinating that he would come back to Phoenix. I mean, because there is some significance to his trips to Phoenix. I mean, he has had two big sort of fiery, memorable speeches last year in the campaign, right after he had visited with Mexican President Enrique Peña Nieto. He came back and he got the crowd sort of riled up about the wall. And then in 2015...
For a little bit, really, let me just interject there. That's the speech that you're referring to is, in Mexico, he was very nice, and then a few hours later, he was very not nice.
Right. Okay. Exactly. And was actually being contradicted by Mexico's president. He was sort of fact-checking him during the speech, fact-tweeting him, if you will. And then the previous year was this, infamous rally, where he kind of went after John McCain, who he still has this enmity. We saw that come out again. He didn't mention him by name, but the guy has brain cancer, but he kept on yelling, one vote, one vote. I mean, it was the sort of almost Dada like, one vote, Tourette's thing.
He also mentioned the other senator that happens to have a conscience of a conservative.
Right. Jeff Flake. And yeah, it's, to get back to your question, like, should this happen? Why is it happening? I mean, I feel like I've almost tried to stop trying to look at the rationales. I mean, and wonder, because we saw there was obviously nobody wants to be thought of that, even that they're just this foil, that they're being used as a backdrop for a political purpose. I mean, the president does have some very strong supporters in Arizona, but. It's strange because Phoenix, one thing that is not an obvious thing is that, when people say Phoenix, it's like referring to Simi Valley as Los Angeles. I mean, like Phoenix is this gigantic place. It's not a monolithic white country club sort of, atmosphere there. It was a different place when I was growing up. It was very conservative. I mean, it was like populated primarily by a lot of white Midwesterners who had gone to Phoenix and started businesses and speculated in real estate and so forth. But it's a multicultural, fairly liberal city. One of the people who is possibly running against Jeff Flake on the Democratic side is the mayor there, Greg Stanton, who's immensely popular. And
he told the president not to show up.
Right. Like, please don't use our city for a political purpose after a national tragedy that has racist overtones. But, who cares? He's a loser, right?
The difference is between most Arizona residents is you actually deal with some of these senators and some of these congresspeople.
Right.
Have you spoken to any of them about this? Not this rally specifically, because I know they're not in session and all that.
Right.
But I think it's fair to say Senator John McCain did not expect for his 2017 to turn out like this.
Probably not.
Okay.
For multiple reasons.
Sure,
obviously,
sure.
His health. But, once you win what is probably going to be your last race, you think that you can focus on just, your legislative legacy instead of just getting into feud after feud with the president. And also, McCain has also praised the president. He praised him last night for the Afghanistan strategy, as did Lindsey Graham, who's one of John McCain's closest allies. So,
Marco Rubio,
right.
who the Donald retweeted this morning. I don't know if you know this, little Marco. I just want to remind everybody, Marco Rubio has small hands. We all know what that means. Donald Trump.
And now he's going to be joined by little George, apparently.
Yeah.
George Stephanopoulos.
So
who referred to in the rally.
You've covered these men. They all happen to be men.
We've
spoken about thus far.
Right. There's one woman in the Arizona congressional delegation, Kyrsten Sinema, who represents Phoenix and some surrounding areas. It's a very swing district, very much a swing district. She also might run against Jeff Flake. She hasn't quite made up her mind.
Okay. So do you think that these people have a chance against Senator Flake?
Yes and no. I mean, I think that the Jeff Flake's probably his biggest problem right now is the primary, because if you lose, so many Trump voters. I mean, it's particularly Jeff Flake has been very open and wrote a book about how the Republican Party is, you know, is off on the wrong foot, you know, and going in the wrong direction. And Trump is a great example of that. That's Jeff Flake's, you know, sort of thesis for this book. If you lose, I mean, there aren't a lot of Democratic Trump voters, you know, that message would appeal to them, obviously. But if you lose a lot of those Trump supporters in your primary, you could, you know, possibly, you know, suffer a primary loss. That's probably Jeff Flake's biggest problem right now. He is a popular guy in Arizona, but if enough of the base turns against him, he could have problems. Now, I think that particularly Stanton as the mayor of a mega city, you know, in Phoenix. I mean, Phoenix has, you know, almost 2 million people. And he has a lot of name recognition in Maricopa County, which is the, you know, is where Phoenix is. That could be a problem for Flake, particularly if he's associated with just being in the Republican Party, which is immensely unpopular right now.
Do you think tonight's event helped, hurt, or did not affect Flake, McCain, all of Arizona? Any Republican at all? I mean, did tonight change anything?
I think it did a little bit. You just don't typically see a president, particularly a first-term president, attack members of his own party. And he didn't, you know, just hold his fire, you know, just with the home state senators, John McCain and Jeff Flake, but he went after Mitch McConnell. I mean, he went after all kinds of, you know, he blamed the Senate. Now, he did also, he mixed his messages a little bit, saying that the Democrats were entirely to blame for
sure. The
failure of health care reform, and said that the filibuster, you had to get through the filibuster because you shouldn't have a 60-vote threshold. But they couldn't even get 50 votes on health care. So it's unclear, but to have a president who theoretically has this big, broad agenda, tax reform, health care, infrastructure, all this kind of stuff, to be attacking members of his own party, whom he will need, is a little... I don't think that helps him. I don't think that helps Trump.
I don't think tonight's biggest story is McConnell being mentioned during the speech. I think today's biggest story about McConnell is the New York Times report about what happened. So... could you summarize this in a way that makes sense?
Yeah, I mean, in very broad terms, there is a, I mean, you could almost liken it to a like a Cold War, you know, between Mitch McConnell and Donald Trump. I mean, Mitch McConnell's style is very sedate and it's very long term thinking, and he doesn't really say anything that he doesn't absolutely have a purpose for saying. And he's very focused on winning and getting the strategy right so his party can retain power in the Senate. That is not really how you would describe Donald Trump, and so the styles are a little different there.
I know you don't know what this means, but to the wrestling, there's a wrestling finishing move called a Styles Clash.
Uh-huh.
It's by AJ Styles. That means nothing to you. Anyways,
I think I can figure that. You know, like,
sure.
You may not know who wins, but you know that there's two different things.
Sure.
You know, two different expectations, right?
Mitch McConnell, to me, is no different than Scaramucci. You might not like what he does, but I always want that guy on my team. Mm-hmm. And Mitch McConnell, if you're listening to the show, you already know this, but like Mitch McConnell is the guy that says, like, our main objective for the Barack Hussein Obama presidency is to not let him win at all.
Right.
It doesn't matter.
Ever.
And
one-term president.
You don't want that as a country, but on your team, that's the guy you want. In theory, that should perfectly gel with Donald Trump. Why doesn't it? Why are they butting heads? Why is there near worlds a Cold War right now?
This is all just my sort of observation, is that McConnell's style is not sexy. I mean, he's like an assassin that leaves no trace. If Donald Trump was going to hire somebody like to, you know, if he was going to hire a button man, he'd want it to be very bloody and loud and public. And that's not really McConnell's style. McConnell likes to get
it done.
Let me
play devil's advocate here. All those guys seem to not be with the administration anymore.
Correct.
So, once again, let's go back to that. Why isn't McConnell the perfect guy? He's a silent assassin. He's not going to take any of the credit, but he's going to get all the things done.
Partly because he has his own power base and his own way of doing things.
Mitch?
Mitch McConnell. And Donald Trump, if anything, needs to give off the impression that he is in charge, that he's the guy in charge. Like, you can't compete. You can't have a competing power base with him Bannon is gone. You know, I mean, like that. That was a great example of somebody with, you know, his own power base, his own, and he went back to it when he went back to Breitbart. I mean, he did an editorial call at Breitbart on his last day in the White House. I mean, technically his last day. He didn't even wait the weekend to get back to his natural sort of power.
It's not that different either than what Sean Spicer did. I mean, if you go to Sean Spicer's Twitter bio, he's never worked in the White House. He just worked for the RNC.
Right.
Everyone goes back home at the end of the day. Trump's home is not with the RNC. Trump is Correct. Not a Republican. Do you think there's a real possibility of him being primaried or just simply deciding to run as a third-party candidate in 2020? I know we're far out. But
yeah, we are far out. I mean, the thing that the Republican Party would provide him that would be difficult to walk away from, regardless of what the circumstances are, is a big institutional support. I mean, getting 50 signatures, like running as an independent, that takes an organization. One thing that we have seen from this administration is it is not terribly organized. And so, like, organizing all the different ballots and so forth, it's just a pain. It's a pain in the ass. And one thing that Trump doesn't have that much of an appetite for is anything particularly complicated. And so having the RNC behind you and having the RNC, I would be very surprised if it actually does turn against him, because they're invested now. I mean, this is the horse, you know, that they rode in on. It's tough to go back. I mean, I can't help but think there are people who hope he decides one term is enough or something like that, but he's not going to be impeached by Republicans in Congress. That's a fantasy, you know, that sort of seems to be keep a currency. But I mean, the Republican Party is not going to they're not even going to censure him. I mean, Paul Ryan went on CNN last night and said we're not going to censure the president. I mean, like, a censure has no bearing on, you know, like, legally it doesn't do anything except just express how Congress feels. I mean, so they're not even willing, Paul Ryan isn't even willing to go that far. So I have a hard time seeing him walk away from the party, and I have a tough time seeing the party walk away from him, because the Republicans also know that there's just a lot of people in the Republican Party who support him.
He's one of the few people that has actually covered this entire city. I didn't say town. This entire city for a while. Is it really any different than it was a year ago, 2 years ago, 10 years ago? Or is it just different actors and it just happens to be a little bit louder?
There are certainly all of the... I think it's worse in terms of the partisanship and in terms of the ability to get things done. I mean, the rhetoric was always there, but underneath the rhetoric, there was also, I mean, the professionals, the people who were in on the game, you know, who, you know, they knew how to actually get a budget deal or whatever you needed, you know, and it started to break down, you know. I mean, it's hard to trace exactly how, but, you know, beginning with the Obama presidency, there was a very intransigent sort of resistance to the very idea of Obama. He certainly didn't do himself any favors by, you know, saying, like, I won. I mean, like, that to the Republicans. That I'm not saying that excuses the way that, like, that, you know, Mitch McConnell said, of course, I just want him to be a one-term president and like, keeping a Supreme Court seat open and things like that. But the certainly the seeds were there. It's just been ramped up, though. And now the issue is we're not quite sure if the competence is there to actually get the actual workings of government done. Because, you know, let's face it, like, the government workings, it's interesting on a level to political people, but it's not exciting. Not like a rally like this. Not like a wrestling match. You
exactly.
I mean? Like, people don't get psyched to see appropriations bills passed.
No.
Well, I mean,
boring.
I know a few people, you know.
Those are nerds, though.
Right, those are nerds. But they're not people who rally and like, show up with signs, you know, and things like that. I mean, that's... But, you know, the underneath that excitement is not clear that there's a basic competence about how to run the government, which you still need to happen.
Why do you need that to happen?
I mean
that should happen, but does it need to happen?
I think on a basic level, it goes back to what the purpose of government is. I mean, like, we I think as Americans, we do feel like we're exceptional, you know, whether that's deserved or not, whether it's a good thing or not. We feel like we've got this thing kind of figured out. This is the best form of government there is. By putting the government on autopilot, you're not really thinking about the future. It's like buying a house and never replacing the windows, never like painting, never replacing your refrigerator. I mean, like at a certain point you should, otherwise you just look like a weird grandma's house. The government is weird grandma's
house. Did you intentionally talk about real estate for any particular reason? Do you see this pendulum swinging? I mean, I think it's fair to say Trump is a reaction to Obama. Obama was a reaction to Bush. It swings back and forth. Do you see it being as extreme on the left as it currently is on the right? Is that even possible?
I don't know. I mean, certainly I didn't expect like Antifa. Is that the sort of anti-fascist,
sure,
you know, militia or whatever it is. I didn't see that coming. So I don't know. I mean, it could be more. There could be a massive swing. It doesn't seem like Democrats are that organized. The left is particularly organized.
You don't say.
Like in that fashion. You know, the Democrats. One of their problems at this point, you know, on a congressional level, is that they still have some of the same leaders that they had, you know, at the beginning of the 21st century, even though they've lost. I mean, it would be like if the Cubs had kept Don Zimmer, you know.
Like, okay, number one, once Don Zimmer left the Cubs, he ended up winning World Series as a bench coach for the Yankees.
After he left the Cubs.
Still won a World Series.
Yeah, but he wasn't a manager.
Dusty Baker.
He wasn't a manager, though.
Whatever. I like that dude because he threw his hat like into the third level of the stance. He was willing to fight people.
He had a metal plate in it. Yeah, I mean, he should use that hat as a weapon. But what I'm saying is, that, you know, if you just stick with the same team that got you, I mean, they're the Democrats in the House, they have a net loss of seats since Nancy Pelosi became Democratic leader in 2003. I mean, that's so until they...
You've been covering Nancy since she's been the Democratic leader.
Yes.
Longer than. She raises the most money, though.
Sure, but she could raise money at her vineyard in Northern California, too.
This is what I don't understand. Why don't the Democrats operate like the Republicans in that way? The biggest Republicans that raise the money aren't necessarily people with...
Right, they're the Mercers and the Ricketts.
Yeah, why
and the Coates.
Why aren't they doing that? Like that, I know that's sort of a rhetorical question, but like, yeah. What do you think is easier? I'm now using you as a strategist. What do you think is easier for a Democrat to convince someone like the Ricketts, like a giant family, to just switch sides and donate all that money to the Democrats, or for Nancy Pelosi to not be the leader of the Democrats? What do you think is going to be easier to accomplish?
I would guess that it would be easier to get people like the Ricketts to start not supporting Trump.
As an outsider, this is not my day job. This is your day job. Mm-hmm. Why am I so surprised by that? That is, to me, more shocking than Trump winning in 16. That, to me, is harder to believe.
Yeah. I mean, I think that in a certain level, like if you're somebody who is a multi-billionaire, you know, who has insurance businesses, say, or hedge funds, if you start to see the consequences of government being run badly, you start to, you know, if you're a good business person, that is, I mean, you pull out, you count your losses, and you write it off as a deduction, and you move on to the next thing. That has not happened with the Democrats. I do not know why. And I'm primarily talking about House Democrats. I don't know why there hasn't been a recalibration of saying, like, we have tried this and it doesn't work, and so we're going to move on to something else. But part of it is that they have a relatively weak bench. People are, you know, they're hesitant.
Hear me out. Throwing this out here.
Sure.
I was born in 82. The Democrats have always had a weak bench, and they've gotten lucky twice in my life. Is that a fair statement? They got lucky with Clinton, and they got lucky with Obama. Those weren't guys that they picked.
That's true. They were not the establishment choices. But they also, they still came up through Democratic politics. I mean, Clinton, you know, had been a governor for, you know,
sure, but he was
years,
no
years,
one.
Years.
Neither him nor Barack Hussein Obama were like the obvious picks. The same way Trump wasn't the obvious pick,
right. But they were politicians, though. I mean,
so they, what? They
They were. They knew politics, and they were. They weren't so unsafe that it was hard to imagine them being
fair statement. Now we are in the level. Jesus Christ. Now we're in the time where safe doesn't matter.
Right.
So. if you're now a Democratic strategist, is there any current senator or congressman on the Democratic side that you would run against Trump and think they actually have a chance at winning? Anyone?
I think, actually, I mean, there's probably a little bit more juice in the governor's ranks of what few governors there are.
Fine, give me one.
John Hickenlooper.
From?
From Colorado.
Okay.
He's a Democrat. He's the governor. He was former mayor of Denver. And he was also he started a brewery in Colorado. So he was originally from Jersey. He went out to Colorado because he was in the oil business. When the oil business went belly up in, you know, the 80s, he decided, hey, you know what? I want to stay in Colorado. I don't want to go back to New Jersey. I've got this geology degree that doesn't, or whatever it was, you know, like whatever enabled him to work in the petroleum industry. He's like, I want to stay in Colorado because Colorado's cool. So he started a business, Wine Coop Brewery. It helped revitalize, like, lower downtown in Denver. I mean, that was a ghost town when that brewery started. And people recognize that. So he went into politics. He's a personable dude. He's kind of amiable. Denver is a better city than when he became the mayor, and now he's a popular two-term governor, and he's running around the country with John Kasich, the Republican governor of Ohio, talking about solutions and how do we do these things, and he's presenting himself as like, hey, I'm cool and a competent person.
Here's my problem with why he's never going to win. Spell his last name. I'm not joking. I mean, when you're running against a guy like Trump, that's, come on,
L-O-O-P-E-R.
There's too many syllables, and I know that sounds insulting, and it's meant to sound insulting. Right. What are your thoughts about Tim Ryan?
I mean, Tim Ryan, you know, he during these special elections that we had earlier this year for all these House special elections that were created by Trump picking people for his cabinet, you know, Tim Ryan went on the road and he you know, campaigned in South Carolina and places and like that that were not particularly hospitable for Democrats. And he showed that he understands that the Democrats can't just be a coastal party. I mean, he's young. He's from Youngstown. He's an athlete. He does yoga.
The reason why
his name is easy to pronounce.
Exactly.
Tim Ryan. It's seven letters.
The whole name. Chris and I are on the Tim Ryan bandwagon, if you're a Democrat, is because he is the only one that was talking about Trump like it's a fight.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think any other Democrat has learned that. It's not about an actual fight. No one actually wants to see anybody bleed. We want to hear people talk like you're going to bleed for us. And he seems to be the only one right now that's in Congress that understands that fact.
I think there are a couple other people, and I meant to mention this when we were talking about members of Congress from Arizona and so forth. One of his big allies in Congress who supported him strongly went against Nancy Pelosi in the leadership election after the 2016 election was over. It was this guy named Ruben Gallego, and he represents the west side of Phoenix and Glendale, where my mother is from. He always asks about my mother. I mean, but I promise that's not the reason that I'm talking about him right now. He happens to know her. She's a precinct captain woman. You know,
I didn't realize that Arizona also had precinct captains. Yeah, that's a very Chicago thing.
It is.
Like John Wayne Gacy.
Well, you know, because like a lot of Chicago people ended up in Phoenix.
There you go.
Because, you know,
we're corrupt.
Because the weather's better in Phoenix. Even if it is 102 degrees, still, as we can see. But, you know, Gallego is a Marine. You know, he's not scared. He's not scared of Trump. He's not scared of Nancy Pelosi. He got shot at.
Yeah, spell that name again. It's not going to happen.
Well, but what I'm saying is, aside from running for president, though, I mean, Gallego is the type of person who you want in your corner and also understands that it's a fight and also has no problem calling people out in very strong language about, I mean, you know, he's taken Trump to task for what he considers hollow rhetoric on veterans. And, you know, what are you going to tell Marine that that's not the case?
Final question. Do you see any Republicans flipping either to independent or Democrat? Not necessarily caucusing with one of them, but actually being a real maverick, not a John McCain maverick, and does not vote with the party 95% of the time, but saying, I am no longer a Republican, I'm an independent. Do you see that happening in the next 11 and a half years? Because like I've said many times, Trump is our first three-term president since FDR.
I don't see it happening.
Could you say something that will cheer up people on the left? Say one positive thing about the world. Give me one good book you've read. Give me some. Have you learned? Because I don't think you've been shocked at all in the last 8 months, because I haven't. There hasn't been one thing that shocked me.
The election shocked me. What's happened since has not.
See, I don't think the election shocked me, only in retrospect, because what you and I witnessed in Cleveland and Philly, we weren't wrong about anything.
Right.
What we were incorrect about were the numbers behind our correctness. Does that make sense?
Yes.
I was convinced that what happened in Cleveland was going to play out in the election. Like, the room was never full. Mm-hmm. The protest never really existed because no one thought it was going to happen. It was too many things that separated people. Therefore, it was never going to work. We go to Philly. Every night was packed. There were too many people. No one could agree on one thing.
Snoop Dogg played.
Coat of many colors.
Lenny Kravitz.
Only now do I realize, oh, that's a bad thing. It's better to just go with one message of, even if it's hate, just go with one message and stick to it, and that will unite people in a horrible, horrible way.
Now who's being the downer?
No, not me. I'm great because he's in the WWE Hall of Fame. So
I will say that I do feel like like any TV show, it gets old after a while, and we're in the middle of a TV show.
And it's getting stopped. That is the perfect sentiment. Here's the thing that a lot of people don't realize. The Apprentice didn't go off because Donald Trump wanted to run for president. The Apprentice went off the air because of low ratings.
Right.